From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. Choreographer Kyle Abraham has expanded the vocabulary of dance. Whether creating work for his own company, AIM by Kyle Abraham, or choreographing commissioned work for companies like Alvin Ailey, Paul Taylor, New York City Ballet, or the Royal Ballet, Abraham seamlessly meshes different styles of dance and music to create an unexpected and coherent whole. He creates dance with purpose. As the founder and artistic director of AIM, he has made a body of dance-based work that's animated by Black culture and history. Work that's informed by and made in conjunction with artists across a range of disciplines that explores the relationship between visual art, music, and dance. He often draws from personal experience as a gay Black man and the struggles, past and present, of being Black in the United States, confronting issues like police brutality, the generational impact of mass incarceration, and gang violence. But Abraham also finds inspiration in the vitality, joy, and cultural creativity that's found in Black communities. In fact, he relies on a sense of community to inform his style of movement, which he calls, and I'm quoting, a hybrid of gritty and a bit of elegance. His dances are propulsive and deeply musical, and he's been praised by the New York Times for his unique talent for finding the person within the dancer and the bodies within a body. Kyle Abraham has won more honors than I have time to name, but they include a Princess Grace Statue Award, a Doris Duke Award, and a MacArthur Fellowship. In 2022, Abraham was selected to be an inaugural member of the Black Genius Brain Trust, and he was also chosen by the Kennedy Center as one of their next 50 cultural leaders, an honor celebrating individuals who are lighting the way forward through art and action. That Kyle Abraham does, as anyone lucky enough to see his work can attest to. I count myself a huge fan, and was lucky enough last year to see his evening-length work, An Untitled Love. And that's where I began my conversation with Kyle. A word before we go to the interview. The audio can be a bit echoey in parts, but Kyle's humor, intelligence, charm, and heart come through clearly. Here's our conversation. Kyle Abraham, I'm going to begin at the end, which is I was fortunate enough to see your beautifully compelling celebration of Black joy called Untitled Love last year. And you can see me bowing. You can't, but I am.
Thank you.
And I would just love to have you tell us about that dance and what inspired it.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So An Untitled Love is a work that in 2018, I started just thinking about. And in the early part of the concept, I was just thinking about, yeah, how can I make something that really kind of is celebrating ideas of Black love, but also self-love in a way, and through the music of D'Angelo. And the through line for me was thinking about my first year in college going to Morgan State in Baltimore, Maryland, and D'Angelo's first album, the Brown Sugar album, coming out at that time. Then thinking about my parents who met at a historically Black college in Wilberforce, Ohio, Central State University, and trying to just kind of think about what their experience was like, think about the beautiful kind of lineage of love throughout our culture that I wanted to find a way to embrace and celebrate in a way that also acknowledged the music and soulful generational history and time capsuling that you can get from D'Angelo's music.
Well, let's go back to that beginning and tell me about your upbringing. And I'm also curious how art factored into it.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania originally, and I grew up with parents who worked for the Pittsburgh public school system and wanted my sister and I to really just be exposed to art and culture to the utmost. They would give us private piano classes at the YMCA in Pittsburgh. We would go to jazz brunch in the city where we just hear live jazz musicians playing. It's just like a special treat whenever we could do that. But I grew up playing a lot of different instruments. I played the cello, the French horn, the piano, did chorus and choir for a while. So all of that was definitely an impact. And they definitely try to encourage learning in all its forms. They definitely had an appreciation for all things art. But ironically, I didn't see a dance performance until I was probably like 15 or 16 years old. That was seeing the Joffrey Ballet perform a program called Billboards, which was all set to the music of Prince.
Wow. I bet that experience opened up doors for you.
Yeah. My friends saw how excited I was, my friends that I went to high school with, and they convinced me to audition for our high school musical that we had in our public school. And then the teachers there gave me a scholarship to study dance over the summer to get better for the musical the next year. And I winded up spending half day my senior year going to Pittsburgh, their performing arts high school, Kappa. So I went half day to Kappa, and then the other half of the day I went to a high school called Schenley, which is where Andy Warhol went to high school. So it was great to kind of have both of those lives. And I was able to play the cello still at Schenley while studying, you know, all my academic courses, and then study dance in the afternoon at Creative and Performing Arts High School of Kappa.
Do you remember, and this is a hard question, but I wonder if you remember what it was about dance and seeing that and seeing the Joffrey that just made your body explode?
Yeah, I do remember, because I think the thing for me is, you know, I was a big rave kid. I was heavily into social dance. But the thing that I saw on that stage in Pittsburgh was I saw dance in a way that I had never seen it before. And I wanted to learn more about it. You know, I think me, like every person I can think of, has at some point gone into their room and made a dance to emote in some kind of way. And seeing the vocabulary that those dancers were using, it made me that much more curious. And different from me playing my cello, where I could sit in my room, regardless of its size, and play, dance was something I felt like I needed more space to be able to explore. And there was a lot that I needed to just learn that I couldn't do on my own.
And you went to SUNY Purchase and studied dance there and got a BFA.
Yes.
And then you got an MFA from NYU. And you go on to dance with David Dorfman's company and Bill T. Jones, but you quickly moved to choreography.
Right.
And I'm curious about what went into that decision.
Well, you know, I think maybe because I started dancing so late, by the time I was taking more than like a class, I was probably turned 17 already. So by the time I get to Purchase, and even that first year of studying dance in that way, I thought about myself being a choreographer. And I think what happens to a lot of people when you're going to a conservatory program, even if you go to school to be a choreographer, it's very easy to get caught up your senior year in particular with what your friends are doing. And, you know, for a moment there, I think I lost what my goal was in being a choreographer and wind up getting a dancing job with Bill T. Jones, which didn't last long at all. But for those reasons. But I think what I realized after getting fired from that job is that I wanted to be in the room, but I didn't necessarily need to or want to be a dancer. I just wanted to be in the room because I loved and still to this day love Bill T. Jones so much, and I love that work. But it was more about me wanting to be in the room. I think the beautiful thing about me getting to work with David Dorfman several years later is I learned that I wanted to be around people who wanted to make work with a certain kind of social conscious effort and people that were really interested in that kind of commentary. And I didn't want to be in a company that was like a full-time situation. And so working with David was amazing in every way. He is the most considerate, kind, supportive person to work with, and was so encouraging for me as a dancer and as a dance maker. We were given a lot of different tasks in the room, and those tasks, sometimes I saved some of those tasks for myself when I realized it wasn't going to be in his piece. I was like, oh, I'm just going to save that for myself. You know, and I think, but I feel like he always was encouraging. And I think that was part of that journey in a way that led me to focus that much more on my own work. And while I was working with David, I was making my own work as well. but not necessarily at the same kind of capacity. I think it was ironically at the time while working with David that my work started to gain more exposure and opportunity, so much so that I had to make a choice. Either my company could tour or I would be touring with David. And knowing that I was employing other people, it felt like I needed to kind of part ways in that way.
Okay, I got to get into your own company because, man, you started one really quickly. It was called AIM, mm-hmm. Abraham in Motion originally. What was the thinking here?
Well, you know, I think, what can I say? Yes, I always loved making work. So there's that. That's like the easy part. I think without even realizing it, I wanted to in some ways make work that was very much from my perspective, connecting to different aspects of my background, albeit either my background in playing classical music or growing up within hip hop and rave culture. It's kind of one and the same, but I wanted that to kind of find its way in a dance company setting. And I felt like, you know, what was happening for me basically from graduate school, which I finished in 2006 to 2010, which is when the company had its big breakthrough. That 4-year time in between those things, I was given a lot of opportunities to perform as a solo artist. And they were great opportunities, but then I would say, okay, well, you should see the group. You know, you should see my dancers. And trying to make opportunities like that, because I did feel like in a lot of cases, the group work spoke to me that much more about the kind of social commentary that I was interested in addressing. So that's a big part of it, trying to acknowledge and understand that in some cases, not all, I do love to have an ensemble to tell a bigger story and get a bigger message across than I can sometimes do in solo form, either myself dancing or me making a solo for another artist like a Wendy Whalen or a Misty Copeland or a Calvin Royal. Working with those dancers on solos is really exciting and fun, but it's different than working with a larger ensemble that I have kind of like honed and can kind of cultivate and curate in a particular way, which of course is different from those commissioned works with those larger companies as well.
Oh, I can absolutely understand that, but man, you're also starting a business. And that has its own particular tedium involved.
I think. Well, you know, I always thought that I was going to kind of either be a business major or a business minor in some way. You know, I always had a love for business.
There you go.
It's like, well, some kids are like building toy houses or whatever. I used to build banks. It was just fun for me. I don't know.
Well, your work is so personal and it's exciting and it's unexpected. And it's work with purpose. Themes of social justice, themes of community recur throughout your work, all the way back to Pavement, which is a really early work that you did with the whole company. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how that piece came together?
Sure, yeah. So a Pavement is a work that premiered in 2012. Its premiere was at Harlem Stage in New York, ironically during Hurricane Sandy, premiered that same time. In 2010, I was talking to one of my former dancers, Amber Parker. I said, Amber, I feel like I want to make a dance about the film Boys in the Hood. And I wanted to be, I don't know why I said this, but to like music written for a contralto singer. Just like random obscure thought. And I started just thinking about what that meant for me and where we as a nation were at in 2012. I was going back home to Pittsburgh. At that time, I was still a Pennsylvania resident and voting there and thinking about Obama and what his election meant for not only our nation, but for our community as like growing up in a historically Black community. And then thinking, of course, about just the ebbs and flows of my community, looking at the buildings in my community and thinking, okay, this building right here has been dilapidated for the last 15 years. How do we, as a neighborhood, as a community, how do we feel? Does it make us feel like leaving home in our community? Does it make us feel like coming back at some point and making a change? Or do we feel like this is the best we got? And it made me think about my experience growing up and getting on the bus in a time of a lot of gang violence in Pittsburgh, which ironically happened around the same time as a film by John Singleton, Boys in the Hood. And trying to draw these parallels for me between the time capsule that is very clearly established in Singleton's film, but also reading W.E.B. Du Bois' Souls of Black Folk and thinking about moments of hope that you can find in his writing, and ways in which I then could draw parallels to where those historically Black neighborhoods in Pittsburgh of the Hill District and Homewood, where they would have been in the 20s, and think about all those theaters which were now boarded up, how thriving they were at a certain point of time. So the work for me was addressing all of those things, while at the same time, ironically, making a work for Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, which premiered that same year, called Another Night, set to Art Blakey's version of A Night in Tunisia. And for me, it was kind of making these works in a parallel way, where Pavement is very much the drama. It is very much like addressing the kind of darkness of the time, the influx of HIV and AIDS on Black communities in particular, of the crack epidemic in our community in particular. And knowing that is a powerful part of Americans' history, because there's a whole other political conversation we could get into with the lack of resources that went into addressing those things, especially at that time. But then also wanting to make a work at the same time, and for Ailey in particular, that addressed the vitality in those communities previously.
You are an interdisciplinary artist in that, you know, you use multimedia in your work. You have a broad range of movements, and you're someone whose dances are set to an extraordinary range of music, from classical to urban to R&B to jazz to hip hop. And I know I'm leaving a lot out. So you have a very wide palette to draw from. Can you kind of walk us through your aesthetic, how you describe your work and what animates it?
Sure. I mean, I guess in a lot of ways, of course, as I already kind of tried to give my parents their flowers, I definitely am very, very grateful to all that they've exposed me to and encouraged me to do and to be aware of. But I think in a lot of ways, in a lot of conversations I've been having over these past 2 years, as you know, so many of us have had these Zoom, you know, Zoom talks, etc., is me kind of unpacking how I saw an artist like Prince, and how in some ways on the dance side of things, you could say that maybe I've fashioned aspects of my career in a certain type of likeness, because Prince is someone who would have had, a single on the R&B charts and at the same time a totally different song on the pop charts. And I don't think he was ever ashamed to do that. I felt like he not only felt empowered to do that, but was like, yeah, this is just who I am. This is what I want to be doing. And maybe in seeing that and seeing this Black man be able to do this in that way, it made me feel like, yeah, of course, this is what I want to do. I can make a ballet for New York City Ballet. And I could make a piece for my, you know, predominantly Black company, or for Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater or wherever else, and speak to different topics, because as Black people, we do not need to be monolithic. So I can make a work for Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater called Untitled America that looks at the cyclical nature of families in and out of the prison system. And then I can go to New York City Ballet and make a work like The Runaway, which I've never addressed what it's about, but that's a whole other conversation for another day. But working with dancers on point and going from the classical music of Nico Muhly to the music of Watch the Throne to James Blake, etc., and know that it is all valid and it is in no way lessening who I am or who I want to be as an artist. Yeah, all of it's welcome. I also like to think about sound and any visual element as well as these other players in this space. And I do love it when I can get to collaborate with different artists. If it's not my longtime collaborative partner in Dan Scully, who does a lot of my lighting and scenic designs, or Karen Young, who's a good friend of mine who's collaborated with me on works like An Untitled Love or Untitled America, both of those two artists being collaborators of mine for those works. But it's also thinking about how can I connect with artists like Titus Kaphar when making a work for AIM called Meditation, A Silent Prayer, thinking about and honoring, commemorating all of the losses that we've had unjustly to Black and brown bodies over the course of time, with texts by Carrie Mae Weems. So it's great to find space to bring in other artists as collaborators to reach not only a broader audience, but reach the message that much more potent.
I'm sure every piece is different, yeah. But I'm curious about your creative process. If you could walk us through it and what you're thinking about in terms of the narrative as well as movement and how the pieces evolve and how they even get started.
Sure. I mean, the process, I feel like it's never the same, really. But a lot of it, I think, in a lot of ways, maybe it's the science nerd in me, it's always starting, probably for a lot of choreographers, it's starting with that bit of a hypothesis, right? Like, how do these things play together? You know, in the case of Pavement, how does it work to take this kind of music written for a concerto singer and think about the writing of W.E.B. Du Bois and Boys in the Hood and bring those things together in a modern day work? All of the works start with that bit of hypothesizing, but then from there, there's space for me to explore in a way that I don't want to sound too esoteric, but maybe in some cases it's creating phrase work. So me creating a series of steps that I either then teach to the dancers or keep for myself, or recording myself improvising over a period of time. And maybe I'll have dancers learn those improvisations. And sometimes it's task-based. Maybe I will give the dancers a different series of prompts, and those prompts will lead something that I then will direct and try and find a way to make sense of. But then there's always a point in the process where I have to go back to what I wrote about and whatever kind of project narrative I would have constructed to kind of hypothesize this work in some way. And that's the part that I think holds me accountable to what it is that I'm making.
Let's talk about the dancers. How do you choose company members? What's the process for trying to identify people you want to work with?
Yeah, we're playing auditions right now, which is pretty daunting. How do I get into it? Okay, yes. So one of the big things that I'm personally interested in is what people may not know who aren't in the dance world. Maybe they just know the kind of cliche of a dancer being one of thousands or whatever in a room to get a singular job. But what I've been interested in doing, definitely over the last 10 years, is changing how that might be for a dancer and for a choreographer. So I will invite maybe a handful of other choreographers in the room with me who hopefully are looking for dancers as well, collaborators, and do a bit of a shared audition. So that's one thing. But to get more to the question itself is, I'm looking for what I don't have in the room. You know, if I have a lot of dancers who can replicate material to do it exactly like I do it, that's great, sure. But I also need some dancers and collaborators who can generate and create movement on their own, because at times it can be a bit redundant if it's just my voice over and over again for an hour. Hopefully your listeners don't feel the same way, but that's part of it. The other thing is just sometimes finding someone who doesn't do anything like me at all and looks so unique that I have to have that person in the room. Those people sometimes are tricky, because now as the company expands and the opportunities for us to expand as a company and to present repertory works, so works that are shorter in length and sometimes works that were previously choreographed and created by another choreographer, I have to think about those artists and whether or not they're able to do those works as well, because the dancers in our company are salaried, you know, 52 weeks out of the year, and we want to make sure everyone is working and feeling seen and feeling respected and all the things. So it does get that much more complicated. But in that audition process, it may start off with, yes, this large number of people in a room that then gets whittled down to a callback. But it slowly, over the course of a week, starts to whittle itself down. And I start interviewing people, because I've realized, especially in these pandemic years, just how important it is to get to know the people that we're going to be spending time with intimately and making sure it is the right fit.
And how do you actually work with them? I mean, we often hear about choreographers making a dance on someone. How much of a collaborative effort are the dances that you create with the company?
I'm so glad you're asking me that question, because I think that there needs to be just a real clear understanding for everyone to know that in what we do as dancers with choreographers, it is innately collaborative. even if I've generated every step as a choreographer and the dancer is taking that step and putting it on a stage, that in its own right is worthy of that person being listed as a collaborator, because there's so much trust that goes into that transfer of information and the embodiment of the information that you're sharing. So there's that for sure. But aside from that, I'm someone that wants to make sure that we can have conversations about what we're making. How does it feel? You know, what is it saying to you as a person who's actually having to embody this movement? You know, a lot of times I'm not performing anymore, especially when I'm making commissioned work. I'm definitely not performing with those dancers. So I want to know what that movement feels like for them. And if it doesn't feel good, we should change it. You know, it's like, it's not that deep. We can change the step. Depending on the themes of the work, sometimes we might spend more time talking than actually moving, because I want to get to the depths and the crux of what is driving me. And for those artists and collaborators, hopefully it's a bit of therapy, but there's a bit of it where we're really kind of trying to unpack a lot of things that are kind of bubbling up for us on both sides. And I think An Untitled Love is one of those really beautiful examples of that type of process, because very early on in the process, I asked the dancers to bring in photos of a couple that they thought best represented love for them. And because it was so early on in the process, there were a lot of dancers that I just hired who were in that room. And that sharing and that level of vulnerability, I think, instantaneously helped to create a very, not only safe space, but a free space for us to feel loved, supported, seen, and celebrated as an ensemble.
And what about when you're commissioned to do a work, Kyle? Like for Alvin Ailey, you just premiered a work in December there for Alvin Ailey, Are You in Your Feelings? Is it different for you to create a commissioned piece as opposed to one that you create for your own company? And I'm also curious, piggybacking on that, how you create a work for dancers you don't really know.
Mm. Yeah. It can be very different. I mean, Ailey is an exception to the rule in a way, because they definitely feel like family. And every time I'm there, I'm thinking, okay, well, if I come back, this is what I want to do next. I also knew going into Are You in Your Feelings what the experience of Untitled America was like for those dancers. That dance in particular required such a level of vulnerability and presence that at times I think it could have taken a toll on them. Also knowing the reach and the impact that a work like that could have on an audience, I wanted to make something that felt that much more celebratory, in a way that they could feel uplifted and just find joy. So that was really important. And overall, with Ailey in particular, I'm always thinking about their reach and their audience. The Ailey audience is such an exciting and vibrant audience unto itself. And so I think about things like the kind of like signature Ailey walk at times, or knowing that sometimes that audience is coming from church and they're going to go see Revelations, you know, like all of, you know, it's part of the culture. It's part of our culture. Mm-hmm. And it's part of what excites me. You know, I also, of course, think about the lineage of Mr. Ailey and the brilliance and the generosity of Robert Battle in the way that he looks at programming for the company. You know, thinking about the amount of inspiration that you can clearly see from Mr. Ailey's works that delve into theater and his love of jazz music. I'd like to find those parallels in what I get to create for that company as well. And sometimes maybe mix that up and play with it in a way that is unexpected. But that's one of the ways in which for Ailey in particular, I'm approaching it. Now, when I'm going to a company that I don't have as much of a history with, it is that much more challenging, because it's kind of like being like, for a food reference, like, what do you call it? Like sous vide, when you're, you know, putting that tight bag. You don't really know how it's going to turn out. You know, it could fail, but you never know, because it's a bit of a vacuumed process, and you're hoping to build some genuine connections. You know, working at an institution like the Royal Ballet in London was really exciting and challenging for a lot of reasons. You know, some of those ballet institutions in particular have so much going on at one time that it's hard to kind of get deep with a dancer in the creative process. And it's also hard to do the prep work to know, okay, well, what am I going to bring to this institution that they've never seen before? And maybe that's not important. Maybe it's not about what they haven't seen before, but like, what is the most honest thing that I can make in a way that feels authentically me while challenging their dancers and introducing their dancers and introducing their audience to me?
You know, you were an outlier in more ways than one during the pandemic. You kept those dancers on the payroll and with their health insurance, and that deserves a great shout out. So I'm shouting that out. And you didn't do Zoom rehearsals.
No.
I mean, even though you're working on Untitled Love, tell us what you did instead.
Sure. Well, you know, thank you for that first mention about keeping the dancers employed and everything, but I can't take credit for that entirely. I definitely need to give the majority of the credit to our company's executive director, Sydney Liggett-Dennis, who just did such an amazing job, not only over the pandemic, but continues to build and support ideas around community within a working place. For the company, you know, thinking about Zoom and rehearsal, it was really challenging for me. And I don't want to say it in a way that comes off with a certain type of privilege to say that I couldn't rehearse. But I think there's a whole other thing that wasn't fully being addressed, is that like, it could have and should have been okay for people to not be okay. You know, like if you felt like you couldn't work during the Zoom era in particular, that should have been acceptable, because it was really daunting and challenging emotionally for a lot of people. But I thought with everything that I was doing over the pandemic, whether it's making several dances or focusing in particular on the ways in which we could work, my goal was to focus in on what we could do, not what we couldn't do. And knowing that space in New York in particular is so expensive that we don't always have the time to sit and talk and unpack a work the way in which I really, really love to do, and the way in which we do when we're in a residency, I thought, okay, well, this is something we can do. So the dancers and I would get together and we would watch a different film or a different TV episode, or maybe someone would have suggested reading, and we would talk about what we saw and find ways in which it connected to either the characterization that people wanted to evoke or employ in An Untitled Love, or how those themes find their way in the everyday life and the experiences and struggles that people might have been going through in the present.
You know, Untitled Love is filled with joy as it celebrates Black culture, Black community, self-love. And it was created during a time of heightened awareness of the long injustices endured by Black people. But you had been looking at that for years, and you chose at that moment to focus on something else, which is the joy that exists in Black communities as well.
Yes, that is very true. I think, I don't know if it's just where I'm at or, you know, what's going on, but I want us to feel celebrated. I think it's just as empowering, or it's an act of activism to find ways in which I can uplift us and celebrate us. It is still just as important for a lot of people to wake up to the injustices that we face, or make works that show a body on the ground as a way of just addressing what's happening all too often. But at the same time, we also need to feel uplifted, and we need to make sure that not only our youth, but also our seniors can feel loved on and celebrated and find hope, because that is so important for all of us, for all people, but especially those of us who have felt discouraged and disenfranchised for way too long.
We've talked about a lot. So tell me, what is the most demanding part of your work?
You know, if I'm super open and honest, which I hope I've been throughout this call, I think I'd say it's really the personal toll of things. I do lead a very lonely life. You know, I live a bit of a bi-coastal life, currently teaching at USC in the Gloria Kaufman School for several weeks out of the year. And other than that, I'm with AIM, my company, or I'm doing commission work. And it can be hard to find not only friendships that can keep getting deeper, but also establish, create romantic relationships Because it's hard to go into, you know, a first or second date and say to someone, "Oh yeah, I live here part of the year, you know, and I travel most of the year." It's hard to say that to someone and know that they're still going to be interested. And it's hard with friends to be in and out of town and then pick up a conversation or get deep and away with something, leave for 6 months, and then think that you're going to continue to be invited to all the things, even as simple as a dinner. So that's definitely my biggest challenge for sure.
And what's the most joyful?
Oh, thanks. That's what I should be focusing
I thought
on.
I'd end with that one as opposed
Yeah.
to
I appreciate it. I appreciate it. My therapist thanks you too.
demanding.
It's probably so many things. I had a really exciting call just before this one with Judy Hussey Taylor at Dance Space Project, just thinking about ideas and around programming and curation and thinking in a way that like goes beyond a stage. Of course, I love thinking about all of the aspects of what we can put on a stage. And I definitely love that. I also love, you know, I just came from the APAP conference in New York just this last week, where we're sharing work, in some cases, for the very first time. We were presenting one of our new works, Motor Rover, a work that I made during the earlier stages of the pandemic. And I realized as the audience was watching it, I was like, no one's ever seen this slide before. This is the first time. Oh my God. So seeing that exchange is really beautiful. Teaching, I can be the biggest geek in the studio when I get an opportunity to teach. I love seeing what can happen in real time. And I love you know, humbly speaking, I love the reciprocity that you can get with students because they're just honest and thankful for the investment that hopefully all teachers are giving them. I see the dedication from faculty to students, and I love that. And I love getting to kind of know students and know how I can kind of in some ways be a matchmaker for them with jobs on the outside or just help them find their way. But yeah, I definitely say teaching in particular is one of them. And I could say the camaraderie that that can exist in the studio with my dancers as well. Just going in and having a moment where we can in the studio play, laugh, cry, dance. And when I say dance, I don't even mean the 5, 6, 7, 8, not like I count, but not in the steps, but in the way that is honest and communal and connects to my background and origins in social dance.
And then finally, what's next? What's next for you? What can we look forward to?
Zoinks! There's so much brewing. AIM goes back on tour. They're on tour pretty much all throughout the year, but we're getting ready for a new season that will be going up to the Joyce Theater in April. But there's several tours that happen before that, a large West Coast tour. And then international touring that will happen over the summer. There's lots of new commissions that we have in the works for other choreographers to come and work with the company, which is something I started in 2018. And I'm really happy to continue to kind of think about bringing in artists, some cases, artists from a generation younger than mine, and in other cases, maybe the same generation. And in other cases, bringing in some of my elders to make work and or restage works that audiences need to see that maybe haven't seen in 20, 30 years. So all those things are happening, and I'm trying to wrap my head around some of the next works for me to be making for 2024 and beyond. Just putting some of that together in a way that I can't announce yet.
Okay. Well, Kyle, thank you. Thank you for giving me your time. Thank you for the wonderful work that you do.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. And thanks for seeing everything and like really seeing it, like beyond the stage, really kind of seeing where my heart is. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. That was choreographer and founder and artistic director of AIM, Kyle Abraham. You can keep up with Kyle and the company, learn more about the dances, and find out where they're performing at aimbykyleabraham.org. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd love to know your thoughts about the podcast. Email us at artworkspod@arts.gov. And follow us wherever you get your podcasts, and then leave us a rating on Apple because it helps people to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.